Hello, and welcome to Primary Sources, a featured production of Radio CALS. Here on Primary Sources, we focus on people who are making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas. Some you might have heard of, and some you haven't heard of, but probably want to know about. Check out cals.org/podcasts for a free podcast of Primary Sources interviews.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Primary Sources, a service of the Central Arkansas Library System. I am, once again, Matt DeCampbell, and our guest this time is Jeff Nichols, Little Rock born and bred, local boy makes good, who's now a big-time writer-director in the movie industry and is graceful enough to be in town and to give us some of his time. So thanks for being here, Jeff.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So before we get into the movie business, which I think we could ramble on with each other for a long time, talk a little bit about growing up in Little Rock, what it was like for you, and at what point did you start realizing that movies were going to be part of your life?
You know, I love Little Rock, and I love Arkansas by extension, but, you know, my parents grew up here in a small town called Altimer, which is just outside of Pine Bluff, about an hour southeast of Little Rock, and I had a really, you know, beautiful childhood. I was a suburb kid in Little Rock and had access to movie theaters and the amenities of a city, but then I would spend summers, you know, going to Altimer and visiting with my grandparents. So I got this really great combination of regular, normal American kid, 80s suburb life and very rural, Arkansas farm life. My grandfather was a propane truck driver. And certainly, you know, this answer is given with hindsight. But that balance between getting to visit rural life but not be trapped in it or live in it, you know, I really grew to love that part of the state, even just aesthetically. But then growing up, you know, my dad owned a furniture store here for a long time. It started as a piano store with my uncle. And, you know, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. I have two older brothers. And it was just it was a really great life. And my dad, you know, he, for whatever reason, I don't know, he didn't have a huge social set of friends or anything else. We didn't hunt. We really didn't fish. We just went to movies. I was in first grade, and he took me to see Pale Rider by Clint Eastwood, which is definitely not appropriate for a six-year-old. And I remember Clint Eastwood's character shoots everyone in the forehead. That didn't bother me at all, but there was a scene where I think a girl's dog gets trampled in a stampede, and I cried. I cried for half the movie. But we didn't leave, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's how my dad and I's relationship really, you know, took root growing up, but it's also how my love for films would kind of take hold. At the end of them, you know, we were like Siskel and Ebert. We would debate the pros and cons of every film, and I remember distinctly being able to open the paper and look at the movie show times, and I would have seen everything sometimes twice. You know, that's how frequent we did this, and so that's, I think, really where, you know, a love for films and cinema started, even though it was definitely from, you know, the multiplex kind of point of view. It wasn't until high school that independent cinema started to bleed its way into, you know, parts of Arkansas and parts of my consciousness, more importantly. And you have films like Pulp Fiction hitting, you know, Park Plaza Mall, and that starts to really, you know, evolve my understanding and knowledge of what film could be. But also, I always liked writing, you know. I was a late bloomer when it came to reading, but I always liked writing stories. And it seemed like in 1997, when I graduated from high school, film school just was kind of a cool idea. I had no concept of what it entailed. I'd never been on a film set, but it sounded like a cool thing. And I was a fair student, you know. I was a B student. I think my teachers liked me pretty well, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't blowing out the SAT or ACT or anything like that. And so, I don't know, film school felt like an appropriate place for me.
Did you get any opportunity when you were at Central to do any kind of student video work or anything to kind of develop that talent or
no,
even
not
in
really.
Your spare time or
you know in at Horace Mann once they asked me to like film a football game and I was so bad at it that they never called me again. No, you know, I was in, you know, my real connection kind of to the art scene in Little Rock started when I was in third grade. I think it was third grade. I auditioned for a part in a children's theater play at the Arkansas Arts Center. I think the first one I was in was Lord of the Flies, which was insane. Like they built a giant mountain on stage and we all ran around in our underwear. It was weird, but it was good. And that really changed my life. I worked at the Arts Center. I would do a play or two a year, mm-hmm. like up through seventh or eighth grade. Then I started playing basketball and I kind of, you know, left that, but it made a huge impact on me. Being around other kids that were acting, but also, you know, the adults that would come through and act in those. And again, this is all judged with hindsight, but I have to think that had a big, you know, formative part of me being open to a career in the arts, me being open to attempting a career in the arts. But there was really no video stuff. Mm-hmm. My dad always had a video camera. Like I remember a trip to Disney World when we were kids, and he had that video camera that it came with the like backpack that carried the VCR.
Yes.
And he, you know, lugged that around Orlando in 100 degree, you know, temperatures. But I think the equivalent of my films were like, you know, action, and it's a G.I. Joe figure with a black cat stuck in the middle. And then we would light it, it would blow up, and then you'd hear me say, cut. And those were the movies I made.
Yeah.
So, no, you know, when I first went, and you know, I was in the drama classes at Central and stuff, but no real film experience. No.
So we talked about that unusual combination of inspiration of Pale Rider and Lord of the Flies. But as a kid of the '80s, you know, what were the movies that you were chasing down on VHS to watch over and over and just having so much fun with?
Well, I mean, you know, being a suburb kid, you grew up on whatever was in the theater, really. I remember being struck by, and I try when I answer this question, I try to be as honest as I can, because mm-hmm. you want to sound cool as a filmmaker when you answer this question.
Of course.
But in reality, you know, like the things that are lodged in my mind are a snow day in fourth grade and my parents, for some ungodly reason, let us watch on VHS RoboCop. And when that guy comes out of that, you know, being dumped in acid and then hit by a car and explodes, like that kind of changed my life.
That's
in a lot
formative
of ways.
Experience.
But, you know, I also remember every weekend it seemed like Cool Hand Luke was on TV, which you don't really appreciate at the time. You're like, this is an old movie that my dad watches,
right.
But I'm going to sit here and like, no man can eat 50 eggs. And then at some point you turn back and that has become, you know, that's in my top five of like most important films of my life. Same with, you know, John Wayne. My dad was a big John Wayne fan. And I remember the first, because I wanted to please him, you know, you want to please your father. And I wanted to watch a John Wayne Western. And again, for some ungodly reason, he started me on The Cowboys, which is the only John Wayne Western where he's killed.
Where he dies.
By Bruce Dern. And that scar. I'm just explaining moments that I was scarred.
It's turning into therapy more.
Exactly. But no, you know, the magic of cinema of the 80s is Spielberg. You can't not talk about him. And, you know, we had Cinema 150 here in town, which I cry a little bit every day when I realize it's just, I think, a parking lot now. But that was a big, beautiful dome theater. And, you know, I got to see, you know, I was born in 78, so I missed Star Wars. But I was there for, you know, Empire Strikes Back. I remember distinctly walking in and seeing a lightsaber fight and Return of the Jedi, the Indiana Jones films. That's also the theater where I think it was around in sixth grade, they did a reissue of Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, wow. And
it was an insanely beautiful film print. And that kind of changed my life a little bit. But they're weird things too. You know, that's what's so great. I remember distinctly going to Breckenridge Movie Theater and watching A Perfect World by Clint Eastwood, which turned out to be a really formative film for me to this day. In fact, I think 2 weeks ago, I just ordered the soundtrack on CD because you can't download it because I wanted it so badly. You know, it was really kind of a hodgepodge of things. I remember also at Breckenridge, I saw Bottle Rocket, you know, Wes Anderson's first film. Right. And I remember thinking, like, okay, there's something else going on here. I also remember seeing The Big Lebowski there. This is in the old Breckenridge Theater before they put it in the parking lot. And the, you know, I remember falling asleep in The Big Lebowski and being like, ah, I don't get it. And then in college, returning to it and watching it 50,000 times and realizing, okay,
this,
you know,
is, yeah,
I need to be paying more attention, you know. I think I saw Raising Arizona at Cinema 150. So, you know, I got it all.
Yeah.
I watched it all and I kind of loved it all. To this day, whenever anybody asks me my top 10 films, I try to always include Fletch. But that's also partly because we had two DVDs in college with no cable, and one was Fletch and one was Goodfellas. But I do think both of those films are masterworks.
So when you get to film school, and I guess what did you walk in the door thinking you were going to do, and then what did you end up doing?
Yeah, you know, again, I didn't really know, but I could. I'll tell you this. I'll answer it this way. I was surprised by how technical it was. I think it very quickly, you know, the comet fell to Earth, and it was like, oh, this is work, and you have to like meticulously set up each of these shots. Like, that seems like so much trouble. Like, it should. It feels so effortless when I watch it. How could it be so laborious to make? And I think the craft of it is really what I was struck by. The good news is, because I'm decidedly not a genius, it felt like something I could learn. You know, I was lucky enough to work on a documentary that a professor of mine made about Larry Brown, the writer out of Oxford, Mississippi. And when I heard him speak about writing, I often apply that to my thinking of directing, at least. Maybe writing, mm-hmm. but I think more talent comes into play when it comes to writing. But I'll explain that later. But he always talked about writing as something that you learn. And he was like, you could read my initial stuff and know that I was not talented. And I taught myself. I did the work. And that kind of journeyman attitude is something that seems like you could apply it to a lot of aspects of filmmaking. Going to North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem, it was an undergraduate program that really, it was bizarre that it existed, but they treated it like a, you know, a school for plumbers or something. Like, you walk in and they teach you how to fold and put up a C-stand and wrap stingers or extension cords. And they basically, in your first year, they were like, if you drop out or we kick you out, you can still go to a film set and get a job. And so those kind of practical mechanics were, because I'm not that guy, you know, like mm-hmm. I don't do construction.
Yeah,
I don't,
you know, not that, very handy.
That's not me.
Me either.
But you know, those basic trade skills I started to pick up on. But then there were other things, like I wrote my first screenplay ever my first year, because we had to do a 5-minute video at the end of our first year on stage in one room. Those were the parameters. And I remember writing the scene, and there was an RA on my hall who was an older screenwriter. His name was Sean Harwell. He turned out to be a really accomplished screenwriter. He's written on a lot of TV shows and movies. And he was like, he looked at it and he goes, you know, this is just, you've just written dialogue, because I just would write the character's name and something with no description. He was like, you need to talk about like where they are and how they're moving. And it seems like such a, you know, simple idea.
Yeah.
But it really kind of blew my mind. And I was like, oh, wait, like this is what, because I hadn't read another screenplay. I hadn't seen one.
Sure.
You know, I'm sure I glanced at one, but like.
You were just writing stories and then attaching the character's name to each line of it.
Pretty much. Yeah. I was just writing dialogue. And, yeah. And it really, I went back in and I started to write how they moved around the room, where they were sitting, what they were sitting on, and those details, and most importantly, that their body language and their movement really started to become the defining thing of the scene. Because I had it in my head anyway, mm-hmm. I just didn't know I was supposed to put it down on paper. And also, it began this great struggle for me as a screenwriter, which is the balance between directing on the page and how to write out specific shots that I see in my mind. Because I do. I dream these things up like puzzle pieces, and I can see the camera movement and everything else. But as a screenplay, along the way, I decided that I just really loathed camera direction in a screenplay. A lot of screenplays you read, and the writer is like, the camera does this, and it moves this way. And I just felt like, in a weird way, as a director, like, don't tell me where to move the camera. Like, I'll decide where to move the camera. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you need to be directing on the page. You need to know what the point of view of the scene is and where these shots are going to go. So this kind of translation that happens from my brain of these images into how that's written on the page. So instead of saying the camera does this, I started forcing myself to say the character's doing this. And if it's about something the character's doing with their hands, you realize that's a shot of their hands, mm-hmm. you know, and there are ways to do it that that separate you from just trying to basically write out a shot list to actually figuring out, why do you want that shot? Like, what's the purpose of it? What's the point of view of it? And in a way, that started me down the path of I think actually becoming a director.
And so when you're talking about this one scene that you had to do for the project, at what point of film school was that?
So that was my first year. Okay. And by the end, you know, we shot it. We were on a trimester system, and we shot it in the third, you know, trimester.
Yeah, this wasn't something you were learning like on your way out as you were about to emerge into the world. This was really
no, this was first year, yeah. You know, and then second year I built on it. So like, it was a really cool program. When I got there, they had just graduated their first class. So the school was only 4 or 5 years old.
Oh, okay.
And they really didn't know what to do yet. They were still figuring out their curriculum. Mm-hmm. But the cool thing they had decided was, we're going to give these kids cameras and hope they don't kill themselves and or anyone else. And so there was this freedom that I experienced there that started to get kind of ratcheted down by the time I was leaving. But you got to make stuff. You know, when I was looking at undergraduate film programs at other places, it was 2 years of theory, and maybe in your third year you get to pick up a camera. And really it just was a primer for you to then go pay for graduate school. And yeah. Actually then you do the real
stuff.
That's
when you really shoot.
And you know, I come from a middle class family. I wasn't going to be, I was impatient, you know. And that was good and bad for the film school. You know, the good part was we were producing short films that were really technically proficient compared to other film schools, certainly compared to other undergraduate film schools. But the content was always somewhat marginal, you know, to be honest, my stuff included.
Yeah.
You know, because inevitably when you get younger kids, it's just hard to develop as a storyteller and have your own point of view. You know, when I came in, everybody was making rip-offs of Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. When I left, everybody was ripping off Wes Anderson. Yeah. And, you know, that's probably true of any film school, but it felt especially true of ours. And because you need more life experience, you need to just read more books, you know, I think in order to find your point of view as a storyteller, you know. But, that school prepared me each year with actually making something.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left, in terms of writing and directing, you know, abilities, I was really confident. The thing I was missing and I didn't know it at the time was producing, like real world producing capabilities, which I had to go fill in the gaps after college with that.
And then at what point, I mean, if it was during film school and after you said you kind of started understanding what it was going to be like to be a director for you, at what point were you starting to finally put shotgun stories down on paper and starting to build it? Because I know it had been in your head for a while.
It had and it hadn't, actually. Mud had been in my head.
Okay.
Really since my sophomore year of college. A guy hiding out on an island in the middle of the Mississippi River. And it being Matthew McConaughey. That was 99, you know? Shotgun stories came around when I was living in Austin after college. So I made a senior thesis film called Noble Chrome Pirates that was kind of based on that Johnny Cash song, A Piece at a Time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about a group of kind of rockabilly guys who are stealing car parts in order to build their dream car. And then once they get it built, then they start fighting over it, and it tears them apart. So they put it on train tracks and run it over. It was a good little short film. And the school would take us out to L.A. At the end of the year, if you were lucky, and show your short film in like a showcase to big Hollywood people. Right. I don't know who these people are, but they lived in Hollywood technically, and I think were probably very important. And I showed my film, and I got a bunch of meetings, and I remember thinking they were really important. And looking back on it now, they were probably like assistants of assistants that came out and gave me a card for something. And one of them was like, you should turn this into a feature film. And I was like, I will. And like, I'll have it to you in 4 months. And so I went back to Arkansas and lived with my folks, and I tried to write a feature screenplay of it. Pretty probably terrible. and I knew it was terrible. That assistant probably had been fired at that point. So, you know, I didn't even have any. And I knew it wasn't. I was kind of doing it because somebody told me to do it.
Sure.
You know? And so that's really when I pumped the brakes. I was working at US Pizza in Maumelle and living with my folks, drinking a fair amount of beer. And I sat down and I wrote my first real screenplay. It was called Blue Side, or Blue Side of Evening, based off of the title of a Steve Earle song. And it was good, man. Like, I haven't read it in 20 years, so
yeah.
I might change that opinion if I read it today. But it definitely started to feel like the point of view I wanted to explore as a storyteller and as a filmmaker. It was about a propane truck driver and Alzheimer.
Imagine that.
And I tried to submit it to the Sundance Labs, and it didn't get in. And I kept waiting around for someone to show up and help me produce this movie, because I had the directing skills, I had the writing skills, but I kind of needed somebody to show up and, you know,
build the production. Yeah.
And of course that wasn't going to happen. No, you know, shocker. Nobody wanted to show up and produce this kid's first movie in Arkansas. So, you know, after a year, like, I was getting kind of depressed and like, oh no, you know, this thing's going off the rails a little bit. My brother had just started film school in Austin, and he started law school in Austin at UT, and I think he'd been there a year, and he was like, I don't know, you can come live with me. I heard it was a cool place. I was terrified of LA, didn't want to go to New York, you know, or terrified of New York and didn't want to go to LA, more appropriately. And so I went down to Austin, and immediately through a connection at my school, I met a woman who was kind of in the film business down there, and I took her out for a drink, and I had a Towns Van Zandt CD playing in my car. She was like, my friend's making a documentary about Towns. And I was like, I'll do anything. And so Margaret Brown was making Be Here to Love Me, this documentary about Towns Van Zandt, and she hired me as a PA. And that was a massive thing in my life for a lot of reasons. One, it was basically me and her hanging out in her house trying to get this documentary made over the course of a year. And I would do anything. I would take out the garbage and, you know, balance the checkbook. But also, you know, we would do these little mini shoots with Lee Daniel, who shot Dazed and Confused and Slacker, great cinematographer out of Austin. And I would get to watch him work, and I would have to order film from Kodak, and I would have to talk to Photokim about the processing of it. And, you know, I was I'd started to learn Final Cut Pro, the editing software, because the year that I was here, I was directing furniture commercials for my dad. and they had gotten me a computer with Final Cut Pro, which I still owe them for. But that would be the computer that I edited Shotgun Stories on, so on that Final Cut Pro system. But anyway, that documentary really filled in the production gaps. Like, I would take, you know, they would build little mini budgets for these little shoots, and I would take those as templates, and those were the templates I used for the budgeting of Shotgun Stories. Those were the scheduling templates that I would use and everything else. So I was learning how to more or less produce a film. And after a year of that, I was ready to come home. I had been thinking about a film I could make. Margaret had given me a copy of Sam Shepard's book, The Motel Chronicles, and I thought that was a cool title. And I wanted to rip that title off. And I'd been thinking about a scene in a Larry Brown book in Joe, actually, which was later turned into a movie by my friend David Gordon Green.
With Matthew McConaughey?
No, with Nicolas Cage and with Ty Sheridan.
Oh, right, right. Ty Sheridan.
Yeah. And
Was it Killer Joe that was McConaughey? There was
Killer
another
Joe
one.
Was
yes,
McConaughey.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank you.
No, okay. Joe is a book by Larry Brown, and there's a scene where he gets shot with a shotgun and has to pick buckshot out of his neck. And I remember thinking, what if a guy, when he was little, got shot with a shotgun, but they never took the buckshot out, and it just grew over in his back? And people told stories about how he got shot in the back, but nobody really knew if they were true or not. And that became Shotgun Stories.
Right.
And so that was kind of floating around, and then I was driving in my car and I heard a song called Decoration Day by the Drive-By Truckers, which is about a feud. And that's when it hit me like a lightning bolt. I had an image of Mike Shannon spitting on a coffin at a graveside service. And I thought, okay, yeah, feuding. But why would they ever let him next to the coffin? Like, why would he ever get that close? They wouldn't. They would tackle him in the parking lot. It's like, unless they were family, you know? And if he was family, maybe they'd let him speak. And what if they were half brothers? And it literally just, it was like dominoes falling. Like, tick, tick,
yeah.
Tick, 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 tick.
Just built the whole structure around.
So I, you know, and this has become a thing with me, and I'm doing it right now with Alienation. Like, I think on something for a good year, maybe year and a half, maybe longer, in terms of mud. And I carry the story around with me, and I keep adding like a tape ball, little things. So after a year, I was ready to move on. And I told Margaret, like, thank you so much. And she was like, please stay on for an extra 3 months. And I was like, I'd just given up my year-long lease with my brother in that apartment. I was like, if you can find me a place to stay, great. And she was like, my friend needs a roommate. And so I went and I met her friend, and that is my wife, Missy. And so I ended up falling in love with a girl from Texas. And of course, like right before I leave to come to Arkansas to make my first film, I have a crush on a girl in Texas, and we started dating long distance. And but after I finished Shotgun Stories, I moved back there to be with her and edited Shotgun Stories in Austin. And I've been in Austin ever since. But it was really Shotgun Stories, very long answer to a short question. Shotgun Stories really developed, and this is important, I suppose, in that year that I was learning how to produce, I was constantly thinking about, not about mud, you know, because
right.
I had mud in my mind,
right.
But that was for later. That was too big. I wanted Matthew McConaughey. I wanted A Boat and a Tree and all this stuff. I wanted something that was kind of like I remember thinking, I wanted it to be like a punch in the gut, like and small and tight and manageable. You know, I wanted to shoot on film, but mm-hmm. I didn't know if I could pull it off. And I remember thinking, if I have to shoot it on a video camera, I will. So it just needs to be visceral.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't say gritty, because I don't think the film is gritty, actually. It's quite beautiful. By the time we ended up shooting it on 35 and anamorphic, it's actually a really beautiful film, which is also what I wanted. But I wanted the emotional punch to be there. I wanted it to be angry, actually. Plus, I was a kid. You know, I was 23.
Yeah.
And you're angry when you're younger. And so, you know, but I was really thinking of it in terms of how to make it. You know, I wrote everything to take place outside during the day. And, you know, because I was also dealing with these shoots, these little mini shoots during the documentary. And I had enough experience on set to know what was easy and what was hard. Shooting at night was hard. And so I tried to make... I built Shotgun Stories to be a festival submission, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was talking to my dad at the time, and he was like, why don't you write like a horror film or a comedy, something that we can actually like make some money back on?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, you know, this is the trajectory. I submit to Sundance and I try to get in, and like I try to do it the classy way. And of course, that film didn't get into Sundance. Luckily, it did get into the Berlin Film Festival, and it had its trajectory. But it was a calculated effort in like every way. You know, the way that you would build a crowd pleaser,
mm-hmm.
I was building a festival programmer pleaser.
Yeah, yeah. And luckily for you, I guess your dad didn't call in the card of, hey, I paid for that computer that you've got Final Cut Pro on.
Not only
what I want you to make.
Not only that, he, you know... my family paid for that movie. And in lieu of a graduate school, you know, we dumped cash into this film, and, you know, we used one of the moving trucks at the furniture store for our camera, you know, van, and we had their Shell credit card that paid for all our gas to get back and forth between Little Rock and Southeast Arkansas. I mean, he and my mom, they put money into it, and they put blood and sweat into it. And so, you know, it's the classic indie film kid story,
right.
But it's one that I owe them a lot for.
So it Shotgun gets the trajectory, you get your exposure, and then before long, well, depending on how long you take in your brain, you're looking at Take Shelter, which was a much greater production on both, I think, scale and
budget.
And budget.
Kind of. What really happened was I was in New York at the Tribeca Film Festival for the U.S. premiere of Shotgun Stories, and a big producer there called me in and said, we want you to do this other project based on a book. And I loved it. And so I actually threw myself for a year into that.
Oh, okay.
And there were a lot of learning lessons. I won't mention it just because.
Sure.
But I remember they were talking about something, and I just blurted out, 3 months. She was like, what in 3 months? I was like, I'll have you a script in 3 months. And I quit my job, and I wasn't getting paid, and I wrote this screenplay, and we were going to try and make this movie. And I remember they called. My wife and I had decided to get married, and we had just sent out wedding invitations. And I get a call from one of the producers on this film. It's like, we got the money, $2 million, and we're going to go make this film. And it's going to start the weekend I was getting married.
Of course.
In Louisiana. And my wife cried a little bit. I think I cried a little bit. And we're like, do we change our wedding date? I remember talking to the producer about it, and she told me very distinctly, you need to figure out where your priorities are. And she meant about with my career.
Right, right.
So needless to say, we didn't move the wedding date, and we just said, well, we'll work it out, you know, postpone a honeymoon, whatever,
like, yeah.
But we'll get it done. And, you know, a month before, I get a call from that same producer. She's like, the money's gone. No, I didn't even get a call. I think I got an email, and I never heard from him again. Hmm. And more or less. And so, and the reason why that's an important part of this story is because now Shotgun Stories debuts in Berlin in 2006. This is now the summer of 2008. And I've spent a year on this other thing.
Right.
And it's no longer there. Hmm. All eggs in one basket, basket gone. And I'm freaking out because whatever
buzz or
juice I had off of Shotgun Stories has dissipated, you know, and I don't even have a screenplay to do something next. So I get back in that mode, that same mode that I was thinking about with Shotgun Stories. Like, what do I want to do? I started writing Mud. Mm-hmm. And so in the summer of 2008, I wrote the scripts for both Mud and Take Shelter. Mm-hmm. And, Mud was kind of this long gestating thing, but I needed something. I knew Mud was still too big. Like, I wasn't even ready as a director to do Mud yet. Mm-hmm. I just knew it. I knew I needed more money, and I needed more skill that I just didn't have access to.
Yeah.
In fact, in a weird way, that was proven from Shotgun Stories. I saw how hard it was to do certain things, and I knew visually I wanted to do things in Mud that I just wasn't ready to direct yet.
Yeah. So when you're writing the two at the same time, are you like completely focused at one, or are you kind of bouncing back and forth? Or?
I was mostly focused on one and then went to the other. Mud was different. I wrote the first like 20 pages of Mud and then stopped. I at least wrote all the way up until the first time that Mud appears and has that conversation with the boys on the mm-hmm. island, mainly because I wanted to hear him speak. And then I set it aside. Then I wrote Shelter. It was called Shelter at the time. And a couple of things about the formation of Take Shelter, you know, I was standing in my backyard, and much like the coffins scene from Shotgun Stories, I just saw a guy standing over a storm shelter, and the doors were open, and it was dark in there, and he was looking down into it, and it was creepy in my mind. I was like, I don't know if he's going down, if he's coming out, if somebody else is down there, but it gave me an uneasy feeling. And anybody knows growing up in Arkansas, every Wednesday at noon, if the sky's clear, they test their sirens. And that felt like something palpable. That felt like almost like a universal, like, bred in fear, mm-hmm. and a fear of weather. And meanwhile, it's 2008, so the economy's about to go in the toilet. I'm just about to get married, and my life is about to start, and I feel like everything around me is collapsing. And I go see The Hurt Locker and the Kathryn Bigelow film. And that film, I was a big fan of Point Break, mm-hmm. and that film really blew me away because I was like, man, she remade Point Break as an art house film. Basically, both films are about adrenaline junkies, mm-hmm. but where there's a point in The Hurt Locker where the plotting should start, the traditional Hollywood plotting. Jeremy Renner's character diffuses a bomb and finds like a signature in the technology to build the bomb. In a bad Hollywood movie, he goes out, finds the guy building those bombs, drops him off a building. The war's over.
With a punchline.
Yeah. And like, great, we're out of Iraq.
Yeah.
Obviously, she and Mark Boal went the higher road, a much better road. But I was struck by the fact that they made an action film that was an art house film. They made a genre film that was an art house film. And I was like, I can do that. I want to do that. Because now I'm not just starting to write for festival programmers. I know that's still going to be the entry point for Take Shelter is a festival, but I was ready for it to be at a festival and then go further because mm-hmm. I'd done one. Now I wanted to do more. And I remember sitting at a Mexican restaurant in Austin with Missy. And I said, so I'm thinking about this guy that's having visions about the end of the world and builds a storm shelter in his backyard. And she was like, yeah, that sounds great. Do that. She's very pragmatic. And so I sat down and wrote Take Shelter. And after those two were written, it was about the time that CAA reached out, my agency, and said, you need to meet Sarah Green. Mm-hmm. She's Terrence Malick's producer, and she's there in Austin. And little did I know at the time, her assistant, Morgan Pollitt, who's now a producer in her own right, was a big fan of Lucero, my brother's band, who did the score for Shotgun Stories, and she was a big fan of Shotgun Stories. And so Sarah Green gets a care package pushed on her by her assistant, which was the script for Take Shelter, the script for Mud, and the DVD of Shotgun Stories. She loved Shotgun Stories. She loved the two scripts. We sat down, and she basically was like, let's go. She was an executive producer on Take Shelter and a producer on Mud. It was really interesting. She was like, Take Shelter's good. In fact, it's great. And I'll help out however I can. I'll be an executive producer. She was like, I want Mud.
Wow.
And
did she know at that point that the history of with you and Mud and how long you'd been wanting to make it and all that, or was it, you think?
I don't think so. I'm sure I blathered about it, you know, and I'm sure I talked about McConaughey, you know, but I would talk to everybody about McConaughey, and everybody was like, really? Like, that's what, you know, because this was in the time of romantic comedies, and mm-hmm. and you know, I started imagining him in that role in the late 90s when he was in Lone Star and other things, but it had never left me, and I was just like, yep, that's him, that's the guy, and so, but Sarah's amazing. Sarah has changed my life in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously, she is an iconic American independent film producer. She said something about her producing philosophy. We were in West Austin at a coffee shop. She said, so here's the deal. I find artists that I believe in, and then I do everything I can to support their vision. Now, a lot of producers might tell you that, but very few producers actually would live that. Mm-hmm. And Sarah does. And it comes with a really interesting combination in personality traits, which is, one, she's extremely smart, extremely opinionated, but she doesn't want to make her own movie. You know, she's not trying to make her movie through you. Mm-hmm. She wants you to make your movie. The best version of your movie, which sometimes you may not know how to do
what
that.
It's going
to
be, right?
but she's there to help you with that, and she's so respectful of me, and Malick, and mm-hmm. David Mamet, and John Sayles. I mean, the list, Julie Taymor. You know, like the list is long and impressive, and And now I've gotten, you know, through the course of working on essentially four films with her, really three that she has been a lead producer on, I've gotten to see that in action, along with our other producing partner, Brian Kavanaugh Jones, which is another great story in and of itself that we may not get into. But the two of them together have been have afforded me the luxury of standing by my point of view.
Yeah. So you get Take Shelter made. Just one small detail out of course, everything going on, but the one that I just remember so well was the New Year's Day when all the blackbirds fell out of the sky in BB, and then your movie comes out and they're like, wow, was this inspired by, but how crazy, because you guys were about to start cranking up publicity on that, right? And then like part of this movie happens in real life.
And somebody sends me that, you know, a link to that. And I'm like, this can't be real. And it's in Arkansas, you know, which is where your movie was originally supposed to take place. It takes place in Ohio because that's where we shot it. But man, that movie was touched by some extra, I don't know, sensory stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a scene in there inspired by a real life event that happened outside of San Antonio about a train derailment and a chlorine gas spill.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Mike Shannon's character is sitting watching the news and he hears about something like this. And he hears about a family being trapped and they died. And it tremendously affects his character because he's like, I'm not letting that happen. Mm-hmm. You know, he obviously applies it to these dreams. We needed a propane tank delivered in the backyard of this house because it wasn't on propane, but we wanted that look for the house.
Sure.
And the local propane guy delivered it. And I think a couple weeks later, there was a spill and he died in it. The day that we filmed the bird scene, I was staying in a rental house and I woke up to a thump and a bird had flown into the glass window of the back doors. Like little things like that, which, you know, look, the universe doesn't care who Jeff Nichols is or what movie he's making.
Right.
But like,
but from your angle,
it was weird, man. And it just kept happening. But then it's funny when people watch that movie, they feel the same way. I can't tell you how many people have been like, and I watched your movie and when I left the theater, it was raining. And you're like, that's weather.
Yes.
That's
known to happen.
That doesn't matter. But that movie, you know, that may be the closest I ever get to the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
I was feeling that fear, that anxiety was palpable for me specifically in my life, but also out in the world. Like that, something was going on in 2008, mm-hmm. you know, and that film came out in 2010. And that's when the crash had happened and we
right.
were really
clawing their way
in
out
the thick of it, you know, not knowing that 2012 was then coming. But, you know, like it was a palpable fear.
Yeah.
I'm afraid it's part of the fear that has kind of morphed and formed into whatever our social situation is now, which is so polarized and heated. But like whatever that fear was, mm-hmm. It took root. And it's found it's now manifesting itself in really interesting, weird ways in our society. But that movie was in lockstep with whatever that feeling was. And I don't know if I'll ever, you can't plan that. You can't, you know, it's just it's a thing that happens and you hope to be the storyteller that connects, you know, like when you read A Tale of Two Cities, like Dickens was on to something like in that moment.
Yeah.
And it you can read that book as much as a, you know, it's like anthropology, you know, you're studying this moment in time for all of its other great uses. But yeah, that was Take Shelter.
And I mean, when you talked about the image that you first had that, you know, in your head that kind of inspired it, and I can immediately see those shots in the movie, as you filmed it, was that still what you were looking at as, you know, this is going to be the moment that resonates the most in the film? Or when you saw stuff, because I think the clip from that movie that I see played more than anything else is the scene with Michael's character at the town hall meeting.
Yeah, there's a storm coming.
Yeah.
It's a meme. Like I've seen they have it on a loop, which is awesome.
Yeah.
I build all my films in a strange way. And it's why a lot of people don't like my films. It's why they think they're slow or weird or strange or boring. And they're not, actually.
No, they're not.
They're not.
I'm not just saying that because you're sitting across from me. They're not.
But it's because I don't do traditional plotting.
Yeah.
I don't think about, okay, you know, this needs to happen to my character at this moment. Like, I don't think about three-act structure. I don't think about rising and falling action and climaxes. I really don't, mm-hmm. which might make me a moron. But it at least gives me a point of view.
It's worked for you so far.
Arguable. And so, you know, I write to an emotional climax. There is one moment in each of those first two films, for sure, and I would argue in Mud as well, and I would argue in Midnight Special and in Loving. So, okay, it's what I do. But there is a moment that I write to, and it is a character moment. It is an emotional moment. Mm-hmm. It's the equivalent of a climax in if you're looking at three-act structure, but it's built differently. It's not built out of plotting. It's built out of an accumulation of moments that make you understand the psychological state of a character at a moment. Mm-hmm. And it should be a punch in the gut. With Shotgun Stories, there's a moment where Michael Shannon's character, his younger brother, has died. And his younger brother had been living in a tent in their backyard. And he has to take the tent down. There's no dialogue in the scene. Yeah. Nothing's going on. It's heartbreaking. And it's the first great performance Mike Shannon's given in one of my movies. And he's given a lot of them.
Yes, he has.
And that's my idea of a great moment. Mm-hmm. Because there are no words, but if people have been paying attention, they're feeling something and yeah. they're affected. Yeah. And which gets to kind of the core mission of everything I try to do in a film is just affect the audience. Because there are plenty of well-plotted movies that you go see that you just don't care about.
Right.
You know? Most movies I don't care about anymore.
Yeah.
I've gotten a little bit more cynical and a little bit more jaded in my viewing, which is on me. But, you know, I want to go to a movie and be emotionally affected. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to write for people, first and foremost. Now, if I was really smart, I would find a way to blend that with a really, like, I don't know, accessible plot. I'm trying with Alien Nation, but I'll probably fail. But with Take Shelter, that moment in the town hall, and oddly enough, it's not the moment when he yells and screams. That's a cool moment.
Right.
And I loved writing that dialogue, like, sleep well in your beds.
Yeah.
Because if this thing comes true, there won't be any more. Like, what a weird, I mean, the syntax of that is just real weird. It's yeah. not a complete sentence, like, but we know exactly what he's saying.
Right.
But no, the important moment is he has this flare up, and then he stops, and it's silent, and he looks over, and his wife and child are terrified of him. Like, that kills me. It just kills me. And you know, like writing Alien Nation right now, like I have this moment in my head and I'm not sure plotting wise how I'm going to get to it, but I could explain it to you and I could explain to you what I want you to feel then. And it's like, and there's no dialogue. And if that moment can happen and the audience feels it and understands it, then I've done a good job is the way I feel. And so, you know, and I could walk you through each film, but right. that for me is the moment in Take Shelter. And there are a bunch of other moments, but that for me is the one that we were constructing the whole thing for.
Yeah. Well, we have to start winding down soon, but we have to talk about Mud first, just because it finally comes together, this thing you've wanted for, and then you get to shoot it. I mean, some of those locations had to be within about half an hour of Altimer.
They were all far, is all
yeah.
I remember.
Yeah.
They were very far.
Nothing was too close to anything, I remember, yeah.
Well, so we'll step back a second. So, like, you know, Take Shelter comes out, goes to Sundance, gets great reviews, goes to Cannes, wins Critics Week, which
yeah.
is the sidebar. And then I'm I'm the flavor of the week, you know, which is great. I'm so glad I was for a week. And it happens that we had Mud right there in the wings.
Right.
And that helped.
Yeah.
You know, like we were taking meetings with financiers at Cannes when I'm there with Take Shelter. Like that's, we were ready, you know, and I hadn't had that before.
Right.
Like with
right.
Shotgun
you didn't have
Stories,
that with Shotgun.
I waited and I wasn't going to let that happen again. And, of course, we're working on casting. Everybody's like, don't cast McConaughey. You got to find somebody else. And we went through those lists and that happened. And I met some really nice actors, but I won't go into the details, but luckily we get McConaughey mm-hmm. and we get our money,
yeah.
which is a bunch of money.
Yeah.
So, you know, Shotgun Stories we made for $40,000. Take Shelter we made for around $800,000. take shelter. We need, or MUD, we need like $10 million, you know, really 11. And, you know, you're looking at tax incentives and everything else. And the producers, as Sarah's, you know, delicately as she can, she's like, you know, the Mississippi River runs through Louisiana, which happens to have a really great incentive program great crew base.
Yes.
And I'm like, nope, Southeast Arkansas looks different. And, you know, I'd been down to DeWitt and I had had a distant cousin that had one of these houseboats and that's what I'd written it for. And I was like, it was just, and it was important to me for all the reasons that I haven't said too, which is, you know, I wanted to bring something to Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily with the help of Governor Beebe and Chris Crane, the film commissioner, we were really able to kind of push the incentive package here and make it make just enough sense. It was still extraordinarily difficult. One, because the crew base, you know, is tough.
It's smaller.
Yeah. It's smaller and, you know, you're bringing in more people and other things like that. I was going to bring in my keys anyway, cause I've worked with the same cinematographer and, you know, that stuff, but we found some great people here. We found some great people and, but it still didn't help the fact that you're based in Stuttgart, mm-hmm. which I wasn't even in Stuttgart. I was at, a duck lodge, which was beautiful, but like it took me 20 minutes just to get into Stuttgart. And so, you know, our mornings and you're shooting with kids. So you're, you know, the unions limit how many hours you could shoot a day. And we have to get in a van, drive to a place that get off the van, get into a like a gator or a mule, drive through muddy roads to get to a riverbank where a boat picks us up and then takes us out to somewhere on the river. And you're like 2 hours into your day before you've even like set up a C-stand. And but that being said, it was magical. It was one of the greatest experiences of my life, partly because I'd been dreaming about it for so long. And Matthew McConaughey opens his mouth, and he sounds just like Mud. Sam Shepard is there.
Right.
And, you know, there's a story I told about Sam the other day after he passed away. And it was, I was sitting on the beach on that island in the middle of the Mississippi River, and I was eating lunch. And I see Sam Shepard walk up, and I'm like, hey, Sam. And I would obviously always get nervous around him. Like, what are you doing? You're not working today, are you? Is everything okay? He's like, I just want to come hang out. And we sat down and we were sitting in the sand and we talked about Borges and we talked about Cormac McCarthy and New Mexico and Jesse James, you know. It was a magical experience. And it kind of solidified this opinion that I have, which is the feeling that you have making a movie, it gets encoded in the DNA of that film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's baked into Mud. And there's a feeling, I love that film. I love all my films.
Right.
I love Mud.
Well, and next time you're back in town, we can talk about, get more into Midnight Special and Loving and hopefully the smash hit of Alien Nation by then. But we have to talk before we sign off about the Arkansas Cinema Society.
Sure.
Which you are the driving force behind. We've now gotten through the premiere. And what do you see ahead now that it's on the ground and now that it's rolling? What do you want to see it become?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I don't want to offend anybody. It's not that, like, I think Little Rock has a dearth of, you know, cultural activities, or quite the opposite, actually. I was just thinking about, like, what can I, as Jeff Nichols, contribute back to a place that has given me a lot? And I thought back to my time in Little Rock and how distant the film industry felt, you know, how not a part of it I felt. Mm-hmm. And it felt like a club that I wasn't ever going to be invited to. And I think had I been exposed to a few people that made films, that would have been a little different, you know? And now I know a lot of these people. I know a lot of filmmakers. I know a lot of actors. I know a lot of production designers and cinematographers and everything else, producers and editors. And I thought if we could not only have a screening series, but have a screening series that not every time, but throughout the year brings some of these people in, mm-hmm. it can demystify the process a little bit.
Yeah.
So I look out, you know, over the next couple of years, and I hope that The Arkansas Cinema Society is still up and running, and I see a network of theaters around the state that are willing to show our films. Mm-hmm. I would love to have a visiting guest artist that just doesn't come to Little Rock but goes to Searcy or Pine Bluff or sure. wherever, yeah. you know? And so that you look up and you have a network of theaters that are showing films that they might not show otherwise. And you have a community of people starting to gather around that it's something cool. They're like, hey, yeah, the Cinema Society is doing something. Yeah. That's worth it. Yeah. We should go. Even if I don't show up or even if, you know, the filmmaker doesn't show up, that's a film I want to go think about and hang out with other people that are thinking about that film. That's the core goal. You know, we also want to start like a lecture series. I'm going to start in November with a series of writing for film. Then I'm hoping into next year I'll do one called Directing for Film and Editing for Film and bring other people in to do similar things.
Yeah.
I also would love to see a grant program started. And I have some strict opinions about those because I've seen good versions of that and bad versions.
Sure.
But a grant program that might actually really help people just with those initial things. You know, we aren't looking to fund movies or anything like that, but the right amount of money at the right time or the right amount of support at the right time. As much as a grant system, I would love to have, you know, how amazing would it be to have Sarah Green and Brian Kavanaugh Jones and Sophia Lynn, my producer on Take Shelter, come in for a day and you sign up and you get to come talk to them about the movie you're trying to get up off the ground and they'll tell you, here's some practical advice.
Right.
You know, I'm not here to tell you if your movie's good or bad or going to be successful. Like, it's not a pitch meeting.
Right.
It's like, well, have you hired a line producer? Do you know what a line producer is? You know, like that to me could be really useful. I hope it works out. You know, we're going to try our hardest to, and hopefully the community responds.
Well, anything you want to know about ACS and what's coming up in coming months, it will appear on ArkansasCinemaSociety.org. Of course, with this and many other podcasts and information about things like ACS, you can find on the Central Arkansas Library System's website at cals.org. Thanks for being here, Jeff. This has been great, and we could go a whole lot longer, but yeah. I know time is tight.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thank you, everyone, for joining in and listening, and we will see you the next time around.
You've been listening to Primary Sources on Radio CALS, a production of the Central Arkansas Library System, its Arkansas History Department, the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies, and the CALS Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information, please visit cals.org and butlercenter.org. Our producer is Glenn Whaley. Production manager is Shelley Stormo. Voices by Jasmine Job and John Miller. Engineering and editing by Anna Lancaster and Shelley Stormo. Our executive producers are Leanne Blackwell-Hoskin and David Strickland.